This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Welcome back. This is part three of my five-part interview with Blanca Simpson, the Murdaugh family's longtime housekeeper. In parts one and two, we heard about Blanca's history with the family, who Maggie and Paul really were, and the mounting pressure the family was under in the months before the murders, including a $30 million lawsuit Maggie didn't fully understand. Now Blanca starts connecting dots on the day of the murders. She saw a white pickup truck at the property that she assumed was Paul's, but Paul's truck was in the shop. She saw a tractor moving towards the back fields, and she has a theory about what someone may have been setting up. But when she tried to tell investigators, they dismissed her, told her she needed professional help. Here's part three. You saw a white Ford F-150 at Moselle that day. Tell us about that truck. I mean, what did you see? Why did it stand out to you? And let's go from there.
It didn't stand out to me at first. When I looked out the window, I saw the white truck, the Ford, you know, F-150 out there. And I just assumed it was Paul. Paul was home, because I knew based on the messages and the conversations that I had with Maggie earlier that Paul, that Alec had asked Paul to come home. So I already knew that. And so there was no, it wasn't odd, you know, to me. When I saw the truck, I just assumed it was Paul. I didn't think twice about it. I said, oh, Paul's home. That was it. I didn't find out until much later that Paul's truck was in the shop. So that's when I was like, well, whose truck was that that was out there? So, and when I left, when I was leaving that after I came downstairs, when I left, as I was walking out the door, I saw the tractor going across the landing strip, what used to be the landing strip, going towards the field. So I just automatically assumed that, oh, Paul's here. You know, he's driving down there to the field.
Yeah.
There was nothing unusual, or I didn't think anything of it, because like I said, I was made aware by Maggie that Alex had asked Paul to come home and take care of the field. And it was my understanding that they were doing some kind of hunt, according to what Maggie had said. So I didn't.
So nothing odd or out of the ordinary about it.
Me at that point,
When you saw that track, and obviously hindsight's 20/20 on this, when you looked back on that truck and then the tractor out in the field that day, who do you think was on the tractor?
I don't know. Whoever was driving that truck that afternoon.
Was it? I mean, I wonder. Do you think it might have been Alec that was driving the tractor out there that afternoon? I mean, I'm just curious. Like, did you get a good look at anybody who was on the thing, or was it just kind of you see it off in the distance, and it's like, well, there's somebody there.
You couldn't really tell anybody, and you couldn't really tell who was inside because of the glare from the glass.
Yeah. Okay.
It's enclosed, so you couldn't really see anybody in there, and that's why I just assumed it was Paul.
Sure.
I didn't feel uneasy about it or anything. It wasn't until later that I started thinking about it, like, you know, well, who was that?
In hindsight, obviously at the moment you didn't thought, you know, it's another normal day here in, you know, Moselle. What do you think they were up to? Whoever was in that tractor was up to?
I mean, looking at it now, my theory is probably setting up for later on that afternoon.
Setting up what, though? What would they be setting up with a tractor?
Possibly finding an area where they could, hide whatever it is that they were going to be using, after the murders occurred, somewhere where, nobody really knew about. That was a large property. There was a lot of areas. There was, I'm not even aware whether the deputies or law enforcement knew of how many access points.
Sure.
There was out there. So that's my theory, that they could have probably, whoever was in the tractor could have probably been, setting up an area where they could move the items that they were setting up.
Did the tractor have like a digging mechanism on it?
It did. It had a like a front end, a bucket?
Okay. Okay. So it could go into the ground. So
yeah.
If I'm not trying to in any way put words into your mouth, but I'm just trying to understand. You're thinking maybe someone's out there somewhere on this property where you could dig a bit of a hole in a fairly easy way, better than just going out there with a shovel and dig a hole. And then if you need to dispose of something in that hole, boom, you can dispose of it and probably cover it up. And I'm going to guess, it's foliage and you can move things around. Probably very difficult, I'm going to guess, to spot exactly anything if someone wanted to make it look like it's just kind of back to nature. Would that be accurate?
That would be accurate, because the foreman used to go out there and work around the fields or whatever. They moved around the tractor. It wouldn't have been nothing unusual for tire tracks or anything to be out there. Mm-hmm. So, the tire, I'm talking about the tractor movement around around the fields, around the little small roads around there. It wouldn't have been unusual because they used a tractor to work on those fields. So there was, they wouldn't have seen nothing unusual unless they knew if they were looking for something.
I don't recall the tractor ever being brought up in the trial or being part of any discussions on this case in the past. Are you aware, did SLED ever take a look at this tractor? Did they ever try and see if it traveled anywhere that day? What was the reaction from SLED when you had brought all this up to them?
I never brought up the tractor issue. I tried to inform them of certain things as they came around and would ask me questions. Mm-hmm. Just like I informed them about the pajamas in the doorway. Mm-hmm. The last time that I advised them about the towel, mm-hmm. Basically they told me to go get help. That I was obsessing. So I just kind of stopped. And at that point, I just kind of stopped. I didn't say anything else. I had my theories. I started piecing things together. I wasn't watching the trial on a daily basis. I didn't really want to see him on the stand because I was still.
Yeah.
It was hard.
Sure. I can't imagine. And we'll get to some of those elements. But so you being someone who knows this family very well, you're part of their, their unit, I would say. Now, there's an inner circle of people and then there's unit. And I would say, from everything you're telling me, how long you've known them, how much they trusted you with their lives and such. That's part of the unit. And SLED didn't want to get they treated you like you're obsessing over this. I would think. And again, we've seen a lot of bad police work before. So I am believing you when you're telling me this. But I'm just kind of shocked where you have this kind of a case and they're just kind of blowing, brushing you off, it sounds like. Were you just as shocked by this?
I was. And it did anger me when I was told to go get help. I tried to give you, ask a question. And for them to come back, for that one individual to come back and tell me that I needed to stop obsessing and I needed to get professional help, it did anger me.
This was an investigator on the case that told you to go get help?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yes. So at that point, I figured they don't want to know anything I have to say. Yeah. They don't want to hear anything I have to say. I didn't say anything else.
When you're thinking this and you're feeling this, because this is what they're telling you, to go get help when you're trying to provide valuable information, because you were there. And they're saying that to you and you're thinking, well, they don't want to know. What's the second part of that thought? Are you got to be wondering, well, why do they not want this information? Why do they not want to know? Why are you thinking they don't want to know what happened here?
I don't know if it would have made a turn on the prosecution. I don't know if it would have changed things. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't understand why they, at that point, I didn't understand why they didn't want to ask more questions other than you need to stop obsessing. You need to go get professional help.
That's the weirdest. And, gosh. The, with the thought you have here on the tractor, obviously it sounds like nothing was ever investigated on it. They didn't dig any deeper. In your opinion, when you think about this, do you think that those weapons and whatever else that needed to be buried is literally sitting somewhere on that property underneath brush and dirt, that if somebody could discover, you know, wow, there's a key piece to this?
There's a possibility, but I believe those weapons have already been moved I don't believe they've been discarded, but I believe because of the value. I don't think they've been discarded or anything, but I do believe that the weapons are somewhere out, not on the property, you know, they're even with, you know.
So you think if they did bury them at that moment in time, right after the crime, because obviously they've never been recovered, that somebody would have gone back and retrieved those weapons at some point in time and gotten them somewhere else, other than value of those weapons? What makes you think that?
It wasn't necessarily, it might not have been weapons. It might have been something else that they were trying to, hide or
whatever it may be, you know, that they would have
put whatever it may be. I mean, clothing,
the shirt, yeah,
clothing,
yeah,
you know, the clothing, the shoes, you know, that sort of thing. But I don't know. Like I said, if you've ever stepped foot on Moselle, on the property itself,
mm-hmm. yeah.
There, that is a large property.
Yeah.
There was four entrances to the property. Two main ones was the kennel and the front entrance. And then there's two more side entrances that would take you around to the one would bring you around the front of the house on that landing strip towards the house. Or if you took that dirt road, There was a small dirt road that would lead all the way around to the corner of the field that was right next to the house. Mm-hmm. The other entrance would bring you all the way into the road. There was a small road. If you went in like on the side where the kennels was, you had the kennels, and then a little bit further down from the kennel entrance was another entrance. Mm-hmm. That entrance would bring you in through the woods, around the back to where they were at one point, there's a big hole back there next to the house, and that hole is for they were trying to actually do a pond back there, but it didn't, you know, they never got a chance to do it.
Yeah.
But that would lead you all the way around to the back of the property that way as well. So
it's a lot of ways to come and go.
There was so many there's so many places out there that I don't think they had enough law enforcement that could have walked or paced around or you know,
yeah,
turned everything. There's just no way.
What was, I know neither Maggie or Paul really wanted to be at Moselle that night. It was an ask of Alec kind of last minute. What did you know about that? Did Maggie say anything about that to you? Or do you know why, what was the reasoning why they were called there that night when they both had other things going on?
The text that she sent me was that Alex wanted her to come home, that Mr. Randolph was not doing well.
Yeah.
And she said, I think Alex, I can't remember the text message verbatim, but basically that Alex wanted her to come home and he had asked Paul to come home. He said, but Paul's coming home to fix up the mess up in the field with the sunflowers. You know, I'm assuming you already know about the sunflowers that they had sprayed weed killer or something on there. So she said, Alec asked Paul to come home so that he can fix the mess up out there in the field. That's the way that she referred it to me when we talked. And other than that, I mean, I don't.
So logical reasons, nothing crazy. He wants some emotional support. His dad's dying and that's his wife. And Paul needs to fix a problem on the property that they were working on. Nothing, again, about as normal as Capri Suns in the morning. I got to say, did you ever go, you know, Alec, you're 40 some years old. Aren't you a bit old for or 50 something? Aren't you a bit old for Capri Suns?
Hey.
They are delicious.
he had some childish ways about him. Not only the Capri Suns, but the chocolate milk, strawberry milk,
yeah,
the cereal, the kids' cereal.
Yeah.
And even of that, he would add sugar to the kids' cereal. I don't.
Did he look for the toy in the box? Was he disappointed like when there wasn't a toy in the box? Like, yeah. I was trying to collect all four. I got the same one again. And then suddenly it's a really different Alec you get. No, I'm just kidding. I want you to sit with all this for just a second. Here's a woman who was inside the Murdaugh family's world for over 15 years. She knows their routines. She knows their vehicles. She knows that property. And when she tries to offer information to SLED, information that could matter, she's told she's obsessing, that she needs professional help. Whether you think her theories hold water or not, the fact that investigators allegedly brushed her off like that, that's wild. In part four, we'll get to the hardest part of the interview. Blanca receives a phone call from Alec telling her Maggie and Paul are dead. She drives to Moselle. She walks into that house 12 hours after the murders, and what she sees, the pajamas laid out wrong, the wedding ring under the car seat, a towel that didn't belong, all of it starts to paint a picture. That's up next in part four. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to this or watching this so you don't miss that segment. It is coming up. And while you're there, wherever you are listening or watching us, be sure to press subscribe. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd greatly appreciate that. And also, your thoughts on this conversation, on Blanca's testimony to what she experienced, let us know in the comments section on YouTube. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
This is part four of my five-part interview with Blanca Simpson, and I'll be honest with you, this is the segment that sticks with me the most. In the first three parts, we covered Blanca's history with the Murdaugh family, the last normal morning before the murders, and the red flags that she noticed, including a mysterious truck and a tractor at the property that day. Now we get to June 8th, and Blanca gets a phone call from Alec. Maggie and Paul are dead. She drives to Moselle, and she walks into that house, a house she had cleaned hundreds of times, knowing she'll never hear Maggie's voice again. What she notices inside raises serious questions. The pajamas laid out with underclothes Maggie never wore to bed, a wedding ring under the driver's seat of Maggie's car, a beach towel in Alec's Suburban that tells her he was in that laundry room. And a moment where Alec comes to her, pacing and disheveled, trying to remember or remind her what shirt he was wearing that day. This is part four. You arrived at Moselle about 12 hours after the murders. You got a call from Alec initially. Let's start with the phone call. What was that experience like for you?
I think I was in shock at first when I first heard it. I didn't. Yeah. When I dropped my phone, I didn't understand what was going on. I honestly thought that he meant that they, and that's what I said, did they go back to Edisto? But sure. I don't even know how to explain the feeling that I got. That was just not something I was expecting first thing in the morning. You know, when I'm getting ready to go out there, I was not expecting that. You know, I had no idea, you know, what had happened at that point. So
what was that drive like for you from home to Moselle as you're heading out there? I know you got there about 12 hours after the murders. I mean, do you even remember the drive? I could imagine this would have been a very, you know, almost out of body moment.
That's exactly how it felt. Yeah. It felt like I was, even though the time was normal, everything was running normal, it felt like I was in a slow motion. And I that's just the best way to explain it. I felt like everything that I was doing was just going in slow motion. When I got in my truck, the first thing that I did is turn off the radio. I did not want to hear anything on the radio, no kind of music, no nothing, because I didn't want to hear whatever was playing on the radio or a commercial. It didn't matter. I just did not want to relay it to that date. So I turned everything off, and all I could hear was the engine in my truck and the road, you know, as I was traveling. And that was the longest, it felt like an eternity basically to get out there. It's almost like every second you were like, you know, one, two, you know, for, you know, as time was passing by. I don't know how else to explain it. It was like time was going so slow.
Sure. Going so slow. And I'm sure in a moment where you just, you know, you want to get through this in a way, you want it just to pass so you can move beyond this horrible truth that, and you don't even know the truth of what happened. You just know that two people that you care about are dead, and you're heading to the house, to the family, to the mourning family. I can't imagine what was going through your mind. When you got to the property, what was it like? Was anything out of place? What were you, was everything, I mean, what was, just give me your experience.
I walked through the door. When I first arrived, I looked. There was no fresh tracks on the grass. And some of the things that I would always notice when I would arrive in the mornings was when somebody would leave, you kind of left the tracks on that grass in front of the house. So I kind of had an idea who had left or who, you know, who had left earlier before I arrived. But that morning as I was driving in, I didn't see no, you could see older tracks on that grass, but you could not see fresh tracks. You would be literally be able to see the fresh and the old tracks on mm-hmm. that dew on the grass. There wasn't any. There was a deputy's car on the left side by the last tree on in the driveway. There's a, they had a line of trees. There was a deputy car right there. I pulled straight up. I looked to the right and Maggie's car was sitting off to the right. Mm-hmm. It was a little odd, but I wasn't really thinking straight at that point. You know, I wanted to make sure that I got inside the house and try to make things as neat and try to make sure that the house was in order for when her parents arrived. That was my main focus, is making sure her parents were going to be as comfortable as I could possibly make them, you know, when they arrived under the circumstances, and her yeah. sister as well, and the rest of the family. I paid attention to, you know, like I said, when I walked in, I didn't turn on any lights. I stepped through the front door. I closed the door behind me. Nobody stopped me. Mm-hmm. Nobody said, hey, you can't go in there. Nobody said anything to me. So I walked through the door. After fumbling with the keys, because I dropped the keys the first, when I got to the door, I dropped the keys. And I opened the door. I closed the door behind me and I took a few steps and I just stood there. And usually they kept, the house usually was like, you know, cold. Mm-hmm. But that morning it just, I don't know how to explain the coldness that I felt. It was different. And it, in my mind, I was still in disbelief that I was never going to hear her, you know, her voice again, or I was never going to, you know, hear Paul. And it was, I had to take a moment and kind of step back. And the only thing I remember is the ice maker dropping the ice. I could hear, I think it did it like twice.
Yeah.
So that tells you how long I stood there, you know, cause I heard it drop the cubes.
Yeah.
But the whole time I was there, it, you know, when I first arrived, it was the feeling of not ever, that the whole dynamic had changed, that I was never gonna, that they weren't living anymore, that they were gone.
Yeah.
Their existence, they were no longer in existence. And it was hard for me because when I would walk in the mornings, you know, Maggie would walk out with her little clunky shoes, whichever ones, you know, and like, hey, Blanc, what you doing? What happened? You know, what did you do? It's just making conversation. You want some coffee? You know, how'd your weekend go, depending on the day?
Yeah.
Or Paul, you know, walking through the door and finding Paul would leave a trail of clothes. And I would fuss at him at times, but, you know, like normal teenagers, it'd go in one ear and out the other. And, but
I want to ask you about Maggie's car. She said it was parked off to the right. And that, I don't know, you've mentioned that that's not where she would normally park her car. Why would her car be parked somewhere else? Because obviously she did go there. Why would her car be parked in a different spot? That's a weird part to me about it. Can you explain that at all? Or do you have any ideas as to why it would have been parked in a different spot? Or maybe she did just park it in a different spot that day? I don't know.
I have theories in my book. And in my theory, I believed he had help cleaning up. Mm-hmm. And I call them the cleaners. And I believe one of the cleaners drove her car from in front of the hangar. Mm-hmm. To the property. And I believe that cleaner was the kitchen entrance was to the right. So he would pull up on that side.
Hang on 1 second, Blanca. You cut out there right when you said, I believe that cleaner was, and then you cut out. Could you pick it up from there?
I said, I believe the cleaner was following Alex, and that's okay. Why the car was parked to okay. the right, because okay. Alec will pull up to the kitchen door, the steps right there by the door. Mm-hmm. And her car was off to the right of him, yeah. to the right of where he used to park. And that was unusual. That was just unusual. That's not mm-hmm. the distance, you know, that she would have to walk to get to the front door.
Yeah. It's like someone who didn't know this situation, but had some brief instruction, go move that car, you know, okay, go put it up by the house. Okay. I'll put it up by the house. That, you know, there was other points that I know you've mentioned in the book about things being odd in the house, pajamas, pots, the bathroom. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Once I got myself together, gathered myself, I went, like I usually did, straight to the laundry room. But on my way, as I turned and I looked, and I noticed the pots were off the stove. Mm-hmm. And that was not normal. That was just not normal for them. Mm-hmm.
Would it be normal for Alec by himself, you know, to be, you know, in a different type of... Like you know, men do things a little different than women sometimes. And he said, like, some of the pots were in the fridge with the covers on and things like. Would that be something Alec would do if it were just him at home, or is it was just like completely out of character for any of them?
That was definitely out of character for Alec.
Yeah.
For Alex to put that, you know, lids on the that wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Maggie would have probably left the pots on the stove, maybe put the food away at times, you know, depending on how much food was left, but not the entire pots with lids in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
That was just not, that was not them. I knew right away that was not them that did that.
And the pajamas, that was another thing about how they were laid out.
Yeah. When I went through the kitchen, going towards the hunting room, that's the other part of the house. When you walk into that little, it's like a little area right there. There was a half a bathroom right to the right. After you pass the kitchen, there's a half a bathroom. Directly in front was the entrance to the hunting room. To the left was the laundry room and the exit door to the porch. Mm-hmm. So when I looked to the left, I saw the pajamas in the middle of the doorway. And I knew it wasn't her. She didn't do that. That was not her. That was not her routine.
What was going through your mind when you know, like, this isn't, she obviously didn't do this? Are you thinking like Alec did it? Like, in a, you know, how some men will like step in like, hey, let me do this for you, honey. And it turns out to be like nothing of how they normally do things. Or was it I'm trying to make this look like something that it's not. Did you think Alec did anything to do with the way it was laid out? What was going through your mind?
Not at that point. I just knew that she didn't do it. And yeah. I knew somebody else had done that. I just knew it was not Maggie.
Retrospectively, when you look at it, you know, with all this time, who do you think it was that did it?
Alec, with the help probably of one of the cleaners.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, that's an interesting move, the pajamas. Do you think that was just kind of a buffoonish oversight? Yeah, like I said, I'm like, you know, obviously horrible situation, but one of those things where make it look like she's getting ready for bed, make it look like she's, you know, going to be staying here that night. And somebody said, hey, you know, should I lay this out? And he's like, yeah, maybe Maggie would do that. Like, just in the moment of stupidity. Because I would think, you know, after how many years of marriage, he would know his wife's routine a bit and wouldn't necessarily think, hey, let's do something that's completely out of character for her. You know, I don't know. I mean, then you got to also throw in the drugs that he was on, too. And sometimes that can convolute thinking. Just the decision-making process on something like that is interesting if you're trying to cover up for something.
I think when you have adrenaline going through you after going through some kind of traumatic event, you have that adrenaline going through your body, you're really not paying attention to a lot of details. And you're, and like you said, he probably did say, well, we can do this. We can lay out the pajamas and put it there.
Yeah.
But, and in reality, you think you're doing something, you know, to throw people off, I guess. But you're really not thinking, you know, all that adrenaline is moving through your body so fast that I don't think you're really thinking it thoroughly. Yeah. I don't think he was thinking thoroughly.
You found Maggie's wedding ring under the driver's seat of her Mercedes.
Yes.
Interesting spot for a wedding ring of a dead person. Did she normally always have that wedding ring on? Did she take it off on any occasions? What did it mean to you to find that there?
Maggie had three bands that she wore on her wedding ring, on her wedding finger. It was a sapphire diamond, a diamond, and another sapphire diamond. It was three bands.
Mm-hmm.
If she removed one, she would have removed all of them. And her usual routine was remove her rings, her bracelet, her, you know, whatever, her watch, if she was wearing it, and either set it up on the windowsill or on top of the microwave. There was a bowl up there where she would put them in there. Or if not, she would take them in the bathroom. And sometimes she would leave them on the corner of the tub. But not just one single band and not the others.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of confusion about that in the beginning. Like, why would she remove her wedding band?
Yeah.
What people didn't understand is that it was three bands on that one finger. And then on the other finger, she had the Princess Diana sapphire diamond ring. That's what she was wearing. And a Chanel bracelet and a tennis bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think people realize that it was three rings, you know. At first, I think people were confused about that.
So what does it mean to you that it was under the car seat? I mean, is this something, there are a lot of thoughts going through my mind of like, was someone thinking they're going to go, you know, make a little money off of this thing after the fact that they take it off of her after the shooting? Is it something she put there for safekeeping? Like what do you think it means that it's there? Who do you think put it there?
The most obvious and the one thing that makes more sense to me is that the ring was removed. I believe whoever was out there helping him clean up removed the ring, was not able to remove the other two. And in moving the car back, following Alec, was probably trying to put it maybe like in a cargo pocket in their pants, you know, trying to put it in there quickly. And it fell out of the pocket and ended up on the, to me, that makes more sense that whoever did whoever moved her car, the person, the cleaner that moved her car.
Yeah.
You know, and basically I believe they got spoofed or something while they were trying to, and it was just like a, hurry up, you know, and was following behind.
And not even realizing it.
Not even realize it until later on when it was brought up, you know, that the ring was under the seat.
Let's talk about the moment when Alec came to you to talk about the shirt, to say, yeah, remember I was wearing this shirt, and you know he wasn't earlier in that day. Was that just a simple conversation? How did that go, and what were you feeling as he walked away?
When he came in the little house, that's the guest house that sits between Mr. Johnny Parker, his old partner, and his brother's house, Randy. There was a small property right there. It's a guest house. When he walked through the door that day, he was pacing back and forth. And then he asked, he said, come and sit down. He said, I need to talk to you. And at the same time that he was pacing back and forth in the living room, he was holding his spit cup, you know, in one hand, and he kept like rubbing his belly, almost like he had heartburn or something. But he was not, part of his shirt was sticking out of his pants. He didn't look put together, if I can say, you know, he wasn't put together, you know. His shirt was hanging out on one side, and he was holding that cup, and he just kept like rubbing his tummy. I could still see him rubbing his stomach, you know, around in circles and pacing back and forth. And he said, come on and sit down. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, he wants me to sit down. Usually if you wanted to talk to Alex, you had to kind of like follow him around because, you know, that's just who he was. So I sat down and he said, you remember what I was wearing that day? And he said, you know, the Vinnie Vines. And I just listened to him. And in the back of my mind, I was like, that's not what you were wearing. But, you know, I didn't really say anything, but it was confusing to me. That's the best word I can use. It was confusing as to why would you be asking me, you know, that. And I did call my husband, and I told him, and he said, well, that doesn't sound right. And I was asked by David Owens if I noted any, and I did mention that to him. But like I said, at that moment, you're not, you know, I just listened and
he had just come back from.
I had no idea that he had just come back from the sled interview that day. Sure. I had no idea. He never mentioned that.
So he's starting to put things together in his mind, and he's starting to see his loose ends, it seems, and he's realizing, oh, that's a bit of a loose end. So I better make sure that his unit, if you will, everybody's on the same page. Do you think he was just expecting do you think he knew what he was doing, that he was kind of hinting at this and expecting just compliance of this is what I was wearing? Do you think he knew that it would come across as, you know, almost like a forceful, like, I mean, in a non-forceful way of, no, this is what I was wearing? Of course it was. Okay, let's move on.
He wasn't being forceful. He was just...
No, but in a passive way.
Yeah, he was, it's kind of like reminding me or, you know, hey, you remember what I was wearing? You know, that Vinnie Vines shirt.
And when you objected to that,
I didn't say anything.
You didn't object at all. Okay.
I didn't. I looked at him and I, you know, in my mind, I was like, no, that's not what you were wearing. And I just, like I said, I listened to him. had no idea, like I said, that he had just talked to Sled and that Sled was looking at him at that point. Mm-hmm. I didn't know.
Are you starting to get a sinking feeling at this point?
Even though my husband told me I needed to be careful, I was still hopeful that.
Sure.
I knew where my husband was going with that, but yeah. Something inside of me didn't want to hear that.
Sure. Well, nobody would want to, you know, that's a hard truth to accept no matter what. Was it the beach towel in his Suburban that was a big moment for you?
Yes. I knew at that point he was in the laundry room.
What did that, when you saw that, what was going through your mind? Why was that the aha moment?
The pajamas were laid out in the laundry room. The shirt he was wearing came out of the laundry room. The towel came out of that laundry room. Mm-hmm. And it just, the towel, to me, the towel was the key. You were in that home. You changed clothes. And like I said, the towel just told me that he was. And then Mr. Waters also, when I heard Mr. Waters say, well, did you have a burst of energy? All of it, were you something about jumping jacks? Were you doing jumping jacks? That his phone hadn't moved. And then all of a sudden he got this burst of energy, you know, so many hundreds of, you know, steps that he made. Mm-hmm. That just didn't make sense. He carried his phone everywhere. He was always on the phone. And then for the phone to go silent and then all of a sudden a burst of energy, to me, tells me that's a person that's running around, panicking, you know, trying to get everything situated and running back and forth to the house. And I don't even know if anybody ever really measured steps from the laundry room to the master bedroom and back to the laundry room, you know, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I just think his lapse, I think he forgot that his wife did not wear, you know, underclothes with her pajamas. And that's where I think that whoever the cleaner was that helped them was, he might have pulled the clothes running back and forth, but I believe that was a setup, because that was my number one clue right there. She did not wear underclothes with her nightclothes.
And if we're talking about a cleaner following him around and you know, helping him about this, that means this was, you know, premeditated, basically. It wouldn't have been a spur of the moment, for whatever reason, somebody snapping and doing this, if you have help that's ready to jump in. Obviously the official story, the official, you know, the way it was, you know, hashed out in court, familial side, he was embarrassed. He was, you know, he had to get rid of his family because he didn't want to face the wrath or the reaction or the shame of all of his financial crimes and everything that was coming along with that and the boat crash, all of that. Think about everything Blanca just laid out. The pajamas set up like a stage, but wrong. The wedding ring removed from Maggie's hand and dropped under a car seat. The towel from the laundry room ending up in Alex's Suburban. Alex's phone going silent and suddenly registering a burst of movement. And the dogs at the kennels, dogs that would have alerted to any stranger, staying quiet. Blanca's not a detective. She's not a forensic analyst. But she knew that house. She knew that family. And piece by piece, she started seeing a picture that the official narrative didn't explain. In part 5, our final segment, I'll ask her directly, do you think Alec Murdaugh pulled the trigger? And she doesn't hesitate. We'll also hear her theory about what happened, what she thinks about the possibility of a new trial, and where things stand now with Buster and the family dog, Bubba. And some very interesting observations about the kennels that night and the dog's activity as Alec Murdaugh was on the phone with 911. Part 5, the conclusion, is coming up next. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss that. It's on the way. While you are wherever you're at listening to our program, when you press subscribe, if you're on Apple Podcasts, do me a favor, put us a review in on our channel on Apple Podcasts. We do greatly appreciate that. And also your thoughts, your feedback, your input on this story. Leave us that on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.